Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 22nd, 2002. Today's session is titled, The Wilderness Speaks, What the Land Can Tell Us. Session 1, The Land Tells Many Stories, An Introduction to Plant Ecology. Presented by Ellen Kuhlman. The number is KUE 2002-01. Let's listen in.
Okay, well, I think we'll get started. So I can start the tape. My name is Ellen Kuhlman, and this week's session is called The Wilderness Speaks, What the Land Can Tell Us. And today's session is entitled The Land Tells Many Stories, An Introduction to Plant Ecology. And I want to welcome you all here. I'm glad to see so many faces. And a little bit about me before we start. I have a master's in plant ecology and botany. I worked for the Forest Service for much of the past 11 years. And while I'm here this week, if anybody has any plants that you want ID'd or something like that, feel free to bring them up and show them to me or talk to me about it. I ordered a couple books in the bookstore that I thought might be appropriate for some people that have certain interest in different things. And my last session this week is actually going to be on fire ecology. But you might before then want to look at this book that I put in there. It's a really, really good book for beginners. And it's actually aimed at older children, like in, I would say, middle school age to maybe high school. But I like it even for adults. In fact, this is my own copy. And if you do look at it before Friday's session, you'll notice that it follows a lot of the same similar lines. And then for people that either live in this area, or if, say, you're coming to Holden every year and you really want to kind of get into what plants are here and not here, I got this book called Plants of Southern Interior British Columbia. And I don't want you to be fooled. It's actually pretty good for this area. It's actually the best book we have. No one's done one for Washington. And a lot of the plants that are in interior British Columbia are down here also. And this book has lots of colored pictures, and it has common names as well as scientific names. And the other really cool thing about this book is that it has a lot about ethnobotany and Native American uses of plants. And so people that are interested in that could get a lot of information from this book. Also in the bookstore, especially for those of you that might live on the west side of the Cascades, there's a book very similar to this called Plants of British, maybe it's Coastal British Columbia, that's the name of it. And that was ordered by the botanist that was here before me, Joe Arnett. And it's also, it's the same format, it's very good. It's more specialized for the west side of the Cascades instead of the east side, which we're on right now. So
there's one called Plants of the Pacific Coast, too, that has similar to that.
Is it?
With the ethnobotany.
Is that in the bookstore, too?
I haven't seen it there, but.
Yeah, there's lots of books out there. Definitely, there's value in all of them, so it's hard to choose which one to do. I'm just going to get this bowl going. And then if someone could get the lights, turn the light back there, we'll be in good shape. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that, although this is a slideshow and I kind of have things I want to say as I go along, if anybody has a question, don't hesitate to stop me or ask something. If you want to know something extra, if you want to don't understand something I say, be sure to speak up. A lot of times when we look at plants, we look at them as just an individual. We just say, oh, this is a really pretty plant. Or you might look at this one and say, boy, I really like that one. Or plants such as this. A lot of times what we don't do is we don't think about how those plants relate into their environment and how they would occur in terms of the larger picture to each other. And the study of ecology basically means looking at living organisms and how they relate to their environment and to each other. So it's about relationships. And so when you're looking at plants from an ecological point of view, you look at a plant like this, but then you'd also step back a bit and you'd look at where is it growing? What kind of place is it tend to occur in? And if I can pull this up. And the same thing for this plant. You can look at it up close, then you step back and you see that be found in a place like this, which is quite different from the landscape that we saw just a minute ago. And so plant ecologists look at that. They look at where plants grow and why they grow there. And to scientists, that's kind of intrinsically interesting in and of itself, and just want to know what's there. There are other reasons why people would want to know something about plant ecology besides for their own knowledge. One thing is that many wildlife species depend on native habitats, and they depend not only on just having space, but on a variety of different plants, either to support what they eat or to support prey animals that they prey upon. Some of the ones that are really common in the Pacific Northwest are very, I shouldn't say common, notable. This is a spotted owl, which many of you might have heard of. It was one of the main reasons why logging changed in the Northwest. It's tied to old growth forests. It needs a lot of big trees to nest in, and its habitat is a certain type. Then you have things, animals such as elk, which range quite widely, and they need a variety of both open meadows to forage in, and then they also need heavy cover, like in the forest as you see in the background, because they need to stay warm at night and they need to hide from their own predators, which are mainly would be cougars or wolves. And then here we have our friend the black bear, who eats all sorts of food as the season goes on, and right now he's in a shrub field, probably looking for some berries. And they, of course, den in the winter, and they need all sorts of different types of plant communities to eat and feed themselves during the year. And in addition to wildlife reasons, of course, we have people, and people need plant communities too. It's kind of the basis for the soils that we use for agriculture were created by plant communities. A big one, which I'm sure most of you know of, is that plants generate oxygen, which we all breathe. And so they're pretty important to us, and we extract a lot of things from them, like wood for our paper and other uses. And so you look at the landscape on a big scale, and you can also look at it in a small scale. Each one has a different community on it. And another reason why people might be looking at plant communities is because they are using them as potential indicators of climate change, and they're also seen as, if they're healthy, then we can perhaps say something about how healthy the world is or the biosphere. So there's a lot of reasons why people look at plant ecology and how plants relate to each other. So I'm going to start out by talking about some of the main types of things that plants need, and they're kind of the main things that determine how they decide where they're going to live. Decide in a certain sense, of course, because they don't really rank. For anybody who might be thinking, this is interesting, but it's way too complex or intellectual for me, almost all of us have been plant ecologists at one level or another, because a lot of us have gardens or some sort of little containers we've made to put plants in. And whenever you do that, you're trying to figure out which plants will grow best together, which plants maybe need sun or shade, what kind of soil it needs. And so in a sense, we've all dabbled in plant ecology. It's just that this is done in the natural world, and you're doing more observing instead of manipulating. So one of the main things that you look at with plant ecology, one of the two main factors, is temperature. Temperature is a main determinant of where plants live, and I've used a picture of sunlight here, so I didn't have one that I thought did a good job of representing temperature. And sunlight, of course, is one of the main things that affect temperature. And then the other main factor that affects where plants grow is the amount of precipitation, and also when it happens. In Washington, we tend to get most of our rain, or is either snow or rain, in the winter months, and then we have a summer drought, which is kind of unique. Most parts of the country and the world don't have that kind of situation. So you have plants that are adapted to either having very little water or ones that can't live without water. They have to have it all the time. It's a water lily. And by the same token, you have plants that sort themselves out based on the fact that they want to be in the sun all the time and exposed, or plants that grow in heavy shade. And then there are a lot of plants that fall in between on both. They can tolerate some shade, some sun, and they can maybe have a bit wider range of moisture conditions. So, and then on top of those basic factors, then you have things that modify them. And one of the main things that modifies both temperature and precipitation in our area is elevation. And this is a picture taken at subalpine level, and you can see there's a lot of snow here. And this area gets not only gets a lot of snow, but it stays wintry for a long time, so the growing season is pretty short. This is not the same area, but this place, I took that picture in late August, early September, and there was still snow there. And so probably there would be snow falling again pretty soon. So some of these areas may never be totally snow-free. This little plant was growing in that same area. And plants up in the alpine, because of the way they're constrained by temperatures being cooler and only having a short growing season, they tend to grow pretty fast. Then at the opposite end of the scale, you might have something like this. This is a picture of the sagebrush steppe, which is out in eastern Washington, east of here. You might have seen some sagebrush steppe on your way to Holden. They don't get much snow, and they get most of their winter precipitation as rain, and they don't get all that much of it. So the plants here have adapted to not having a lot of precipitation and to having quite a bit of sunlight. And in addition to changes in elevation, you have just the fact of simple differences in aspect making differences in where plants will grow. This is a picture of a north slope versus a south slope, and the north slope still has snow on it and the south slope doesn't. This is another view of kind of the same area. So as you might imagine, the south slope, both because it gets more sunlight and a greater amount of temperature, gets higher temperature, the plants there are going to be adapted to being more drought resistant and being able to tolerate being in hotter conditions. And then on top of those factors, so far we have basically temperature, water, and then we have things that modify that, which I've said are elevation and aspect. Plants also sort themselves out based on the type of soil they need. This is a picture of a plant, a bitterroot, growing in very thin soils. And it likes to grow there. In fact, it's only found in thin soils. And then this is a sunflower that grows in deeper soils. So you wouldn't find either one of those plants in the opposite situation. So it's not dependent on the temperature or the rain as much as how deep the soil is. So you take all those factors together, and then you start looking at a landscape, and that's how the part comes in where you say the land has tells many stories. Because when you look at a landscape, the trees and the plants don't actually start talking to you, but if you look at them and you know a little bit about what they tend to grow in, you can start talking a little bit and thinking about what kind of past history has gone on here. This is a picture, if you can see, it has kind of widely spaced trees, has a lot of understory flowers. And the one thing you can tell just from the picture is that the plants obviously can tolerate quite a bit of sunlight. And if you were to walk around there, you would notice that the soils there are kind of medium, they're not real thin, they're not real deep. And if you poked into it a bit further, and maybe did a little reading, you'd find out that these trees that are here, ponderosa pines, which I'm going to talk more about in a little while, tend to be very drought resistant, and they're also very tolerant of fire. And so one of the reasons why this site has widely spaced trees is because when fire comes through, it tends to kill off the younger trees, and so only the bigger ones can make it. So you can look at that and think, say something. If you go to a landscape like this, already given what you know, you might be able to say a thing or two. You can see from this picture that we're at a bit higher elevation, and in the foreground we have a big shrub field, and in the back we have a bunch of trees. And so you might just hypothesize that there's something different either about the soil or some factor that's made the shrubs grow in one place and the trees in another. You might guess that the reason that we don't see a lot of wildflowers here is because there's a shorter growing season. And you may or may not be right. I mean, when you're out looking at things, you just kind of say things, and then later you can revise it if you want to. And so you start looking at kind of how things are arranged and what that might mean. In addition to these main factors, which kind of determine where plants are going to grow based on their tolerances to amount of sun, amount of rain or snow, or their need for a longer or shorter growing season, you have the fact that there are disturbances to the system. And every time something happens to change things, then plants kind of react to that. And so I'm just going to flip through a few slides of certain disturbances. This is a picture of logging. You can see some stumps pretty clearly there. A real common one in our area, and one that a lot of you experienced on your way up here if you came in the last week, was fire. And that's pretty common in forests, especially on the east side of the Cascades. These trees were all killed by a beetle. So we also have insect attacks that can kill off trees and change things around a bit on the landscape. Then we have disturbances such as mining. This is a picture of the tailings, which Holden Mine is a deep rock mine. You can also have damage and change to the land through surface mining. This was a surface mine, and it's left quite a different plant community than the surrounding area. And then again, you have other types of human disturbances that also alter what the plants are doing in and of themselves. So to kind of summarize what disturbance can do, this is kind of an extreme example. This is a place where they had a real high intensity fire that came through, and it killed the trees, and it also did a lot of burning of the soil surface. And what happens with a severe type of disturbance like this, what you're changing is you're changing the amount of light, and you're oftentimes changing the amount of water that'll get into the soil. One of the things forests do is the water kind of percolates through the various layers of litter at the surface, and it gets into the soil that way. If you have a surface that's more impermeable for any reason, where in this case it would be because a fire burned it, then the water will run off and you'll end up with soil erosion. So disturbances basically create a change, and then the plants react to that. And oftentimes the same plants will come in, or different ones. If you think about some of those shade plants I showed you a little while ago, if that shady plant was living underneath these trees, it wouldn't grow back right away because it's going to be too sunny for it. So different plants will grow back here. So it kind of creates a change that'll last at least for a while. So go back to the garden analogy for a second. I've already touched on it a little bit, but the other thing that will happen is after you put a plant in a garden and you set it all up just the way you want it, if you don't take care and trim them or take out the weeds, what'll tend to happen oftentimes is that certain plants will really expand their territory and other plants will shrink their territory. And some of the most beloved plants you might have put in will just kind of die off altogether and not be there. And that happens because plants, in a sense, compete with each other. They all have their different tolerances for light and moisture. And then when you put them into a situation, they do the best they can. And so in a sense, the plant that has the best tolerance for the conditions it's in will expand the most until something stops it, whether it's another plant or the conditions change. So now I'm going to take you through a little bit of a scenario with using the same plant species under different conditions and kind of showing what can happen if the conditions are either right or not right. This is our friend, the ponderosa pine, again. And ponderosa pine grows on the east side of the Cascades, usually in the foothills up until it gets a bit too much moisture, and then Douglas fir replaces it. So it's not here. There's not a whole stand of ponderosa pine right here at Holden, but there is some ponderosa pine right down the road. So this is a seedling, and our happy little seedling grows. And then sometimes things happen to it. You can see in this picture, there are trees that have some dead portions on the bottom. And the reason for that is that the center of this picture is pretty wet and boggy. And this tree is very drought resistant, but it doesn't like having its feet wet, especially for very long in the growing season. So essentially, these trees will eventually die out right in this spot here, and the meadow will increase its size. And it'll probably stay there until the hydrology or the conditions underneath the soil that are making it a wet area change. So the little seedling didn't find a good spot there. And then here you had where there was a lot of seedlings, and they all grew up, but they're kind of crowding each other out. There's not a lot of sun here, and these are the same things, ponderosa pines. And they all look a little bit spindly. And ponderosa pine, when it doesn't get enough water for itself and it gets too big, it tends to be susceptible to disease. And this is true of many plants. The disease is in the middle. It's actually an organism called a mistletoe. It's kind of right in the center there along the branch. And mistletoe over time will weaken the tree, and if not cause death directly, it'll facilitate other organisms to kill the tree. And then another thing that can happen to ponderosa pines is that if you take the disturbance away, as I mentioned before, it tends to have this relationship with fire. If you take the disturbance away, then you're going to have trees growing in to take over. And it's hard to see, but a lot of those little trees are actually Douglas fir. They're not ponderosa pine. In fact, there's a Doug fir right in the front there of the picture on the right. And so what happens in this case is eventually, if a fire doesn't come through pretty soon, this site will no longer have ponderosa pine on it. It'll have Douglas fir, a different species altogether, because the Douglas fir has a different tolerance for moisture conditions, and also for it can tolerate a bit more shade than the ponderosa pine. So this is back to a similar picture to what we had a while ago. If everything works out well and the seedling falls in a place where both it has either the right moisture conditions and light conditions, and it has the ability to not be too crowded, and perhaps if fire comes through here once in a while to keep the other species out, then you'll end up with a scenario where you'll have big, healthy trees. And in this case, because they don't tend to grow too close together, you'll have a lot of other understory plants with it. And this kind of thing happens in all sorts of other environments. This is a picture of Mount Hood, and you can see that this is kind of a subalpine to alpine picture. Alpine means that you're above the tree line, and so when you get scattered trees like that, that's called a subalpine condition. And in this case, probably the limiting factors are a lack of temperature and perhaps to some degree moisture if most of the year it's cold enough that the plant can't really access the water so well. And then of course at the top, it's just too cold and probably too much snow on the top to have plants growing. These plants are very big. So you can take kind of these basic principles and kind of apply them to different scenarios and different places you're at and kind of think about what's going on. This is a picture that was taken up in the Copper Basin Trail. And this is also kind of a wet situation. You can see our little tree there in the foreground. It may or may not make it because this is another place where it's pretty boggy and it's higher elevation, so it's pretty cold. And that meadow is probably mostly maintained by the fact that it's wet and it had a pretty short growing season. And here you have another plant that has a different kind of requirement. These are aspens, and it's on the edge of a meadow. And aspens, along with the ponderosa pine, have a relationship to fire. They tend to, if they don't have a fire come through, they'll get kind of, the older they get, they'll get more susceptible to disease and they'll die out. But if you had a fire come through here, then the aspen would be regenerated. Their root system usually isn't killed by fire and they send up new shoots from the roots. So what you want to try to do with plant ecology, I think the most important thing I could say is to just get out and look at plants and just try to think about not just how beautiful the flower is, but if you want to work on it a little bit, think about where you're standing. If you know a few basic principles, like about how much precipitation an area gets or what elevation you're standing at, you can make a little prediction about what kind of conditions the plant's looking under. Look at other things that are around it and just think about it. And sometimes, you know, you can do this no matter where you live. My examples, of course, are the east part of the Cascades, but my best advice is to try to find a spot where you can go back several times at different times of the year and just kind of see it under different conditions. And that'll help you get to both know the place and to kind of understand how the different plants relate to each other. So you want to look up close. You can look at the individual plants. And then you take a step back when you're observing, and then you look at the plants in relationship to the other things that are living there. And if you're really kind of want to get technical and you want to know the name of every plant, you might want to break out your books. And there's all sorts of technical characters that you can look at to decide what plant exactly you're looking at. Don't be afraid to get dirty sometimes. You might have something happen where you get a little dirty. This was actually, I was out doing some surveys and I fell up to my knees in this muck. Luckily, I wasn't on my own. Someone had to pull me out. And the best part of it all, I think, and the thing I would say is most important, is to just have a good time with it. Don't be too serious and don't get too frustrated if at first it just seems too complicated. If you learn a little bit at a time, eventually it'll become a little bit clearer to you and the land will start talking to you and you'll see a lot of what's there. So that's the end of the slide part of the show. We can get the lights. I don't know if anyone has any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer questions.
What are the characteristics of the ponderosa pine that make it more tolerant to fire?
A fire? The basic things, excuse me, I have a cold. Basic things that ponderosa pine have are they have really thick bark that's very resistant to burning. It almost acts as an insulator. And a lot of cases you'll see fires come through and the outer bark will be charred, but it won't even get through to the inner part. Trees all have what they call a cambium, which is this ring where the water and the nutrients flow up. And as long as that's not damaged, the tree's okay. And that's one of the main things of bark. So the bark on ponderosa pine is really important. Another thing it has is it has buds that are really big and they're kind of protected. So that means that even if, say, a fire were to sweep through and scorch all the needles, if the buds survive, then it will be okay.
B-U-D or buds or the
buds? Buds for like where the next year's needles come out. And then the other thing that it has is that it has a tendency to self-prune its branches as it gets older, so that there aren't a lot of branches right into the ground. One of the problems with the picture I showed you where you had the ponderosa pine and the other little trees next to it is that if you had a fire come through there, the fire would go from the ground to the little trees and then up to the top of the ponderosa pine. You have to have a pretty, what they call a tall fire height for it to get into the ponderosa pine crown. And it's really, with the bigger tree, it's only when you get a crown fire, when it burns the top of the tree, that you even have a potential for killing it. Now, if they're growing too close together, like that one picture I showed you, if the fire gets too hot, then even the bark won't protect it. So it's more designed for what they call low-intensity fires, which are ground fires that just kind of creep along. Yeah.
Yes, the question here, if fire is so beneficial to a number of organisms, why do we not allow them just to burn?
Well, that's a good question. One of the things that happened is that, of course, we didn't used to know that. They used to, for years, in fact, the Native Americans used to set fires. And we realize now that a lot of the landscapes we see, especially on the east side of the mountains, but on the west side, and it's also true in the Midwest prairies, were actually modified by the Native Americans. There was an idea when white settlers first came here that they thought the Native Americans didn't have much effect on the land. And sometimes you probably heard that the phrase as well, they just lived with the land. Well, that's not actually quite true. They did, but they also modified things to make it what they wanted. Like, let's say an area had huckleberries or blueberries, they would set a fire to heat the trees out of that area so that it would stay basically a field of huckleberries. And they did the same things. They set fires in the grasslands to either drive game or they had different agendas. And so when we moved in, essentially, and moved them out, we had no knowledge of this on the one hand. And then on the other hand, we just didn't want fires. They wanted the early Forest Service, of course, they wanted to harvest the trees, so they wanted the trees to be alive. People that were building their houses didn't want the house to be burned up, and we had very little potential, especially back early in the century, that when a fire got going, you didn't have much of a chance of stopping it, and the fact of it being uncontrollable bothered people. Now, scientists know a lot more about how fire interacts, especially in certain places, but what tends to happen is that, well, two things. You have a political reality that whenever there's a fire, there's a big public outcry, and the media always portrays it as this huge, horrible thing that's happening. And so the agencies, such as the Forest Service, get a lot of pressure to put it out. And the other thing that's happened is because we've suppressed fire for so long, we've built up the amount of fuel. Figure there used to be a fire going through somewhere every 5 or 10 years. If you don't put a fire in there for 80 years, then you have a lot of buildup of fuel and stuff. And so you won't necessarily get the same kind of fire now that you would have then, and you could create more problems. So
it seems to me that the reason we have these huge fires is for that reason, is because of the amount of fuel.
Yeah, it's a lot to do with that. And the Forest Service does now have a program where they're trying to reduce the fuels, and they're trying to basically, in a lot of cases, recreate at least in ponderosa pine, create the structure that used to be there by getting rid of the smaller trees and some of the underbrush. But it's very costly to do that. Mm-hmm. You can't necessarily get a logging company to buy that. And so either you have to do it yourself, or you have to actually pay them to come in and take out the small trees. And There are places where they've done that, where they can incorporate things of a large enough diameter that a logging company will buy it, and a lot of the mills have retooled to do really small diameter trees. And so there is some of that work going on. There's just a huge amount of acreage out there that needs to be done. And the problem that happens is that the money that's targeted to do that can be shifted to other things. And like right now, some of the money that was budgeted to do fuels reduction is now being put into wildfire fighting, because that's kind of something that has to get done. And so the Forest Service is going to try to get more money out of Congress, but as we know, Congress has other priorities these days, so we'll have to see how much money we get.
Is there some movement now that after there is one of these huge wildfires, that after that they go in and they do some controlled burning, so that in the future it doesn't build up and the fuels don't build up so much, or that they keep some of the fuels out?
Yeah, that is kind of the long-term goal. The long-term goal is either in areas where you've had a fire, or if you've gone in and you've done some silvicultural reduction, is that the idea would be to maintain it more with prescribed burns. The problem comes in is that they have very specific criteria for when they can burn and when they can't. Like, the fuel moisture has to be not too wet, not too dry. Because if it's too dry, then they're afraid it'll get out of control. You can't have a lot of wind. So sometimes they'll do all this prep and they'll be ready to go, and then it's a windy day and they can't do it. And the other thing that kind of plays into here is that more and more people are building houses right at the edge of the forest. And there's not a lot of regulation, especially in the West, to stop someone from building something right up at the edge of the, let's say, the National Forest boundary. And of course, if they have a house there, then it's hard to do a prescribed burn. It's this area that they call the urban wildland interface, and it creates a lot of problems. And it's been getting larger because more people have been moving out into the rural areas. So that is it. It's kind of an idea, and it has been implemented a little bit, but it hasn't gotten anywhere near off the ground the way it would have to be effective.
We came up over Navarre Coulee, and there's an area up there where they are developing, and they have a huge collection of mobile homes, and it's just like a development up there amid all of this small size ponderosa pine that are real close together, and it's just like a disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah, and I would never live there personally. I mean, I drove over there also, and you may or may not have noticed, but that a lot of that area actually burned in 1994, and a lot of those trees, especially if you go, when you go out of the village, if you're going to drive back that way, try to notice that, because some of them have charred bark near the ground, but the tops of the trees are just fine. That area you talked about where they're real small diameter and they're close together, that part didn't burn.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting. I was thinking as I was driving over that part might have actually, some of those trees might have died if the fire had actually gone that direction, but it didn't.
But and now they've built this whole development of mobile homes right in the midst of those.
Yeah, places. And so if there is a fire in there next time, there'll be a lot of pressure to try to dump lots of water on there or something. But a lot of times what happens is that people just end up losing their house, because in a situation where a fire is really going, there's not actually that much people can do about it. And there's not enough firefighters. And I was talking to a couple people beforehand that we actually in Washington had 4 people die last year when they were trying to fight a fire. And we've actually had a couple of accidents already. A couple of air tankers have gone down and planes have gone down trying to fight fires. So you get the, you have to balance how important are saving either the trees or the structures versus people. And more they're trying to back off and saying, well, you know, it'd be nice if we could save that house, but it's more important that we keep everybody safe. And at a larger societal level, we have to think about how do we want to spend our money? You know, do you want to spend your money pouring water over this person's house so they can live out in the wilderness? Or do you want to spend it on either creating healthier communities or even on a different program altogether that benefits something else? So, yes.
I just think that there we should look at some sort of control as to where people build. In the, you know, you can build in the wilderness, but that looked like an utterly ridiculous
situation. The one thing that is happening in some places, someone told me this, and I haven't checked it out for myself, is that there may be a certain control happening where insurance companies are starting to decide that they're not going to insure these places out in the middle of the woods. So people may decide or not decide not to build there, but it's up to them then that they're taking the risk. And that could be a curve for some people on not deciding not to build there.
In the fire that they're fighting now, who pays the firemen and how do they get that? Is that state, federal, county?
Well, it's a mixture. All sorts of different groups have their own fire crews, but when the fire is burning, say if it's burning on national forest land, ultimately the federal government's going to pay for that. Most of the firefighters are federal. There are actually some private contractors now, but they are contracted then with the federal government to fight the fire. So most of it's our tax dollars that are paying for it.
And when it gets in close to a town or something like that, it's the local fire department that's out there.
Oh yeah, that's true. And in fact, when we had fires in, I think it was in 94, they were so bad and they were so long-lived that by the end, we were actually even having urban firefighters coming over to just give relief to some of the wildland firefighters. That's hard to do, though, because they have different skill sets, and people that are really good at, say, evacuating an office building or finding a trapped child in a house may not really have a clue about how you really fight a fire that's, like, racing down the slope towards the river or something like that. So, but yeah, when it gets close to town, definitely, then that urban firefighters come out, and they're really good at protecting structures too, really good at kind of trying to hose down the houses at the edge of town. So, yes?
Back when there wasn't so much fuel available and these fires were natural and nobody was around to necessarily put them out, or they just didn't for whatever reason, were they, you know, lower to the ground and not quite as intense heat, and did they still burn for as long? Like, they're always talking on the news, it's burned yada yada acres. Mm-hmm. So when these fires didn't have so much fuel available, did they still burn for as large of a distance, even though maybe not as high to your frequency?
Well, it really varied, because in areas, let's say like in the grasslands or ponderosa pine, they would have been very low intensity and go for quite a long time, especially if they were set either naturally lightning. We don't have a lot of lightning here, but we do have some lightning, dry lightning storms set up by lightning or the Indians in late summer or early fall when things are really dry. It would probably go a long ways. Also, there are areas when you get higher up into the subalpine and alpine where sometimes, usually in most years, it wouldn't get dry enough for that stuff to burn even if you had a lightning strike. But you can sometimes, it'll get dry enough. And those trees have a lot of oils in them and resins, and they burn really hot when they burn. So, and if you think of a fir tree, it tends to have branches closer to the ground, and then it goes up in a little cone. And so those usually would burn really hot and burn the top. So it was really patchy, depending on where you were. If you get up high, probably the fire rotation was more like, you know, every 300 or 400 years, and down low, in ponderosa pine, it was between like 5 and 15 years, something like that. But there were places where the there are interesting accounts if you look historically. If any of you do live in this area or have traveled a bit, there's an area called the Blue Mountains. And the reason they got that name is because when the explorers first came through there, it was this blue smoky haze. And that's what the haze was caused from. There's so many fires in the late summer. So that's where the name comes from. So in late summer here, I think it was pretty smoky a lot of places. anybody have any other questions?
I may be getting ahead of ourselves, but is there places where you can walk to? Do you see these wildflowers in bloom right now?
You know, I haven't found too many flowers yet. I was looking. Has anybody else seen flowers? You've seen some flowers? Did you see any, Bill, you went to 10 Mile Falls. Did that trail have some flowers on it?
No, not that many yet.
No. Yeah, the thing is that when it gets into midsummer and it's drier, then the flowers are kind of not as in evidence. But we'll definitely see some. I've seen some asters and some other things out there when I've been looking. And there are some shrubs blooming right now, like I saw an ocean spray that I'm probably going to take people to see tomorrow.
There's one right next to the park.
The ocean spray? Oh.
They planted one in there.
Yeah, well, that's great. Yeah, that's the other thing. I am not an expert on native plants, using them in gardens, but it is a kind of growing thing, especially for people to do that because they are more adapted to the local climate. They don't need as much fertilizer or herbicide, and they take less water. So I'm glad to hear that they have some in their regular plantings.
Well, the alpine areas, they usually figure mid-July. Mm-hmm. When you get up really high in those areas.
Which we don't have time to, but if you went up higher, like towards mm-hmm. Lyman Lake and Cloudy Pass, there's probably a lot of wildflowers blooming right now up there. So, anything else? Well, thank you all for coming.
And thank you.
Hope to see you as the week.